Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Mr. Tom Beal. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Ursula.
On the morning of November 4th, which was Monday, a young man named Tyler Comstock was killed by Ames City Police after a high-speed car chase and bumper car-like collisions, which ended on the lawn of Central Campus. Such an event of escalating violence, ending in death, cannot help but leave a community shaken, especially in a community like ours, where an officer-involved shooting is a rare occurrence. There are questions and concerns, and such an event can become very divisive. Our mission at KHOI is to engage and help communities, so at such a time, especially, we want to provide the time and opportunity for discussion.
Story County Attorney Stephen Holmes has agreed to join us this morning. It has been his role to investigate police actions, and he has agreed to talk about what actions he has taken. Good morning, Steve. Before we start, let me review briefly what occurred. On Monday, November 4th, Ames Police got a report of a stolen car. As reported in the Daily News, Tyler Comstock, 19, of Boone, Iowa, had been arguing with his father before leaving a spring green lawn care worksite at which he worked with his father. His mother said Tyler was upset with his father because he would not buy him a pack of cigarettes. At a little before 10:30 a.m., police were dispatched a description of the vehicle he was driving as a stolen vehicle, and Officer Adam McPherson saw the vehicle on South 4th Street. He attempted to stop the vehicle, but it did not stop. Tyler Comstock drove north on Beach Street, where he suddenly stopped, reversed, and rammed into McPherson's police car, pushing it sideways. Tyler then continued driving at high speed through a red light at Lincoln Way. Comstock drove to the Iowa State campus the wrong way up a one-way street, followed by Officer McPherson and Iowa State University police officer Tony Atliano, who were in two separate police cars. Comstock then drove onto the lawn of Central Campus, followed by the police cars, where they collided some more. At one point, Comstock's truck drove in reverse at high speed and crashed through a homecoming display. Pedestrians ran out of the way and the police cars tried to crash stop the truck. When the police cars became disabled, the policemen left their cars, the truck careened nearby aggressively, and at around 10:29, Officer McPherson fired his gun 7 times at the back of the truck cab, killing Tyler Comstock with 2 bullets. Comstock quickly was transported to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Stephen, have I described events correctly?
Well, Tom, good morning, and Ursula, good morning. I would say that a summary of the events are fairly accurate.
What happens when such an event occurs, and where were you when you first got the call?
I was actually attending continuing legal education. I was not here in Ames. I returned to Ames later in the afternoon of the 6th, and I met with police authorities at the Ames Police Department, including Agent Don Schnichter from the DCI.
What are the next steps, or what were your options in this case? I assume one of them would be to call a grand jury hearing or to determine if there is some further investigation or perhaps prosecution necessary.
Well, Tom, I think for your listeners, it's important to understand that my function is rather singular as the county attorney. Matters involving a shooting death of this nature would come to me for review for a narrow set of considerations. And under Iowa Code Section 804, which is the laws pertaining to the use of force and the laws pertaining to the use of force in making an arrest, I was brought in simply to make a determination as to whether the use of force in this instance was lawful. Now, I can expand a little bit on that. If, for instance, you were walking down the street as a citizen and a police officer summoned you to help him in making an arrest, let's say he had the occasion to encounter a purse snatcher, and in that instance, the officer was chasing him. Perhaps the officer stumbled and asked you to help him. The amount of force that you are able to use is categorized as being reasonable under the circumstances. There's also a term that comes up for me in this, which is justification. Justification is your ability to use force, whatever force is necessary, again, under a reasonableness standard, depending on the circumstances, to defend yourself or to defend others. So that would be the consideration that I was asked to come in on.
I know one of the questions I heard raised was why you issued your statement so early, so soon after the event.
Well, normally this kind of a matter would, I think, take a more it would progress more slowly. It's my understanding that in this particular instance, and I'm not exactly sure where this is occurring, but apparently there is an organization, for lack of a better term, that is recording police 911 or police radio broadcasts. And this apparently is new. And I was asked to come back because the broadcasts that were being, or this broadcast, or Ames Police Radio Traffic, had been broadcast. That's why.
So the story was already out and needed to have some response.
Yes, there was some concern about the communities not seeing the entire matter and not understanding the full nature of what had occurred.
Do you get any communications from this group?
I had no knowledge of this group whatsoever. I did not even learn of it until I had returned.
Steve, can you explain what is the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation?
Sure. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation is an arm of the state government. It is officed primarily in Des Moines. It has agents around the state, and it will send agents out to assist in investigations. Usually they come in on more serious investigations such as involving a murder or other more serious investigations. They assist law enforcement agents, local law enforcement agencies, and they will also assume the investigation for a local law enforcement agency.
And are you the person who enlists their help?
The request for the DCI can be made by my office. Every county attorney in Iowa is the top law enforcement officer in the jurisdiction of the county which they serve, and also the request for aid from the DCI can be made by the local law enforcement agency. When there is a shooting involving an officer, usually that agency asks for outside assistance in investigating it, just for the appearance of it. It could be, for instance, that a local law enforcement agency, a municipal police department, for instance, could ask for assistance from the sheriff's office. But usually these days we see the DCI.
So you were the person who determined that they should be involved?
No, I did not. That was a request made by the Ames Police Department.
What steps did you take to arrive at the conclusion you did? What do you actually do together?
I did not participate. I did have an assistant go to the scene because I was not here. And when I returned, I went to the Ames Police Department. I met with a number of command officers. I began to learn of the matter. I was presented with a brief summary, a written summary, and then I was informed of what other media was available to me, and I used two in-car videos. I also used a citizen's video. I spoke with two of the on-duty commanders of the Ames Police Department. They came back to speak with me, and that was later that afternoon. I also spoke with my assistant who was on the scene, and I also spoke with the residents of the home where the matter all started, and I had some other conversations as well.
We're speaking with Stephen Holmes, Story County attorney, and we're speaking about the aftermath of the November 4th killing of Tyler
Comstock.
Steve, you issued a statement more or less exonerating the officer for the shooting, and I wonder if you could talk about what you what your conclusion was and what happens next.
Well, Tom, what I was asked to do, again, is rather narrow. I think the term that you used is better phrased by exactly what my role is, which is to look at the incident only in terms of the officer's use of force based on the circumstances at the moment. And again, under Iowa law, a person is able to respond with the necessary force to defend themselves or to defend others. You have the right, for instance, if someone should break in your house, you have the right to use, under Iowa law, any force necessary that you feel you need to use to protect yourself. And you can also use that same level of force to protect others. In this instance, a law enforcement officer, of course, is sworn to uphold the laws of the state of Iowa. And this is one of those very difficult matters for people to understand in terms of how force is to be exercised, that is, how reasonable force is to be exercised. In this incident, or this series of incidents that occurred, as troubling as they are, and certainly I would like to probably take the opportunity to say I agree with Ursula that these matters are, well, they certainly affect everyone in the community. I don't think anyone can escape the feelings of, well, that just naturally occur. But the series of incidents that transpired here involving the decisions of Mr. Comstock are very dangerous. If you watch the video, the collision first on Beach is a very violent collision. That was very disturbing to watch. The next few series of maybe 30 seconds for Mr. Comstock to get to the intersection of Beach and Lincoln Way, when he crosses Lincoln Way, I just shuddered. If he had struck either of those lead vehicles with that big truck and that trailer, I doubt whether any occupant would have survived. That would have been on the driver's side of the vehicle that was westbound. And those are extremely alarming facts for the pursuing officer. And you have to remember the pursuing officer, when you were giving the rendition of the matter, the Officer McPherson was dispatched a description of this vehicle, and the description and the circumstances were that this was a stolen motor vehicle. And that's all that Officer McPherson was given.
In your report that you gave to the police officer...
You mean that I provide to the chief?
The chief, right. And as you explained earlier this morning, that's not a document that's normally public.
Well, what I mean is when I present that to a police chief, or if it was the sheriff, whatever jurisdiction we're talking about, that letter to them is a confidential communication. However, they're certainly free to, as in this case, make that public.
Which they did yesterday at a press conference. One of the points you made in the letter, you had a phrase where you say, at the point where Mr. Comstock rammed Officer McPherson's car the first time on Beach, you say at that point the officer could not disengage.
Correct.
Can you explain what that means?
To me, in seeing that, again, the officer's duty is, he has a sworn duty to protect the community. He has just been assaulted. That's a felonious assault. Using a motor vehicle in that manner, a motor vehicle would be considered a dangerous weapon, just like a gun. And so the officer now is aware that the operator of the motor vehicle has committed a felony. And now matters change dramatically. Now the officer has to be concerned about himself on an entirely different level. Now he has to be concerned about members of the community on an entirely different level. And he really can't just pull over and stop. It's one of these terrible combinations of things. Now, if he would have allowed Mr. Comstock just to disappear, and let's say, as in what happened just about a year or so ago, here in Ames. There was a drive-off from West Ames, and the officer was in pursuit. Speeds reached almost 100 miles an hour, really very quickly. So the officer discontinued that chase. The driver did not stop and did not slow down. Almost a mile later, at the intersection of Duff and Lincoln Way, there was a collision at about 100 miles an hour. One of the occupants of the person who was fleeing, of their vehicle was killed. And the other occupant of the vehicle that he collided with was seriously injured. The officers are placed in a very difficult dilemma when something like this takes place.
I then have to ask the question that almost everybody asks immediately, then why didn't they just shoot the tires of the car?
Well, this isn't the movies. And the officer, again, has been trained, and again for the general public, shooting the tires out of a vehicle is something that you see from Hollywood. That isn't something that an officer could do for several reasons. First of all, hitting a tire is not necessarily an easy thing to do. Missing the tire is a much easier thing to do. Also, the officer has only a certain number of rounds of ammunition. The officer doesn't know, and did not know in this instance, if the occupant of the vehicle is armed. You wouldn't shoot your ammunition away and then have the occupant of the vehicle step out and shoot you when you were out of ammunition. Again, shooting at a tire or shooting at a moving vehicle, the rounds that miss, the officer has to be cognizant of what's around him. And in all of these areas, there are people everywhere. You can't apply a Hollywood analysis to this.
Steve, let me pick up on that a moment, because what we're trying to do is kind of answer questions that have been raised. And one of them raised, in fact, in the Iowa State Daily is concern that the bullets that the officer shot might possibly have hit someone else. And I guess the question is, when an officer is obliged to use his weapon, what efforts are, what is their concern about possible bystanders being hit?
Well, again, my take on this is the officers could have shot at Mr. Comstock at several different points. When there was the collision on beach, and then again when Mr. Comstock is engaged and takes his motor vehicle off of the roadway and into the grassy area of Central Campus. They didn't shoot then either. In the backdrop, you can see people running. I'm confident that their discretion at these two instances is key, and it was a part of my rationale about their consideration and their deliberation, even under these rather fast-moving circumstances. It wasn't until the final location, which was down and in a way, it was in a wooded area, and they were in a better position, it seemed to me. And they could, at that point in time, see a better idea of what was behind them in terms of the possible trajectory of a spent round.
The fact that no one else was hurt is important.
It is important. It is very important.
There was concern that he was spinning the wheels of the vehicle, apparently trying to get away again, and that possibly, I'm sure, related to or was a factor in the officer's actions.
That was my understanding, that the officers have a concern now that this is going to go to a yet another location. The officers are going to lose what control they have over the situation, because both of the vehicles that the officers were driving had been damaged. Officer Adelano's vehicle had become immobilized by a rock, and then I understand Officer McPherson's vehicle was also out of commission.
There was another question raised, and that has to do with the fact that we don't have a lot of violence in Ames of the type you'd see in a big city. And the question is, what training do the officers in Ames have for this kind of situation?
Well, that's probably a question better answered by the chief of police, and I'm sure he'd enjoy an opportunity to explain that in detail. But I do know generally that officers undergo training throughout the year, and they have to qualify every year in terms of using their service revolver or service weapon.
Well, one other quick question, and that is, often when an officer is engaged in a fatal shooting, there are consequences for him personally and so on. And do you know if there is a program where they get counseling or something to help them?
I am aware that these days those services are provided. They are made available through the various departments, and I do know that that does take place.
Does the, I guess, the county or the city provide services in any way to dealing with, for the to provide support for the community or for the family of the person that was killed? Is there any outreach efforts made to address it on that level?
From the county level?
Well, or from the, whether it's local or county government, are there any programs for giving support to the people who've lost a family member from the shooting, or in terms of the community service, other than obviously your willingness to come here this morning, which we do appreciate?
Well, you're very welcome. I would say that perhaps indirectly, there isn't a doorway with a sign over the top of it that says anything specifically about what you have asked. But should the person, family members, have difficulties resulting from this, that there are all kinds of services that are available in the community for that, and various organizations who are prepared. For instance, for children, if the children of family members in this are having difficulty, then there are a number of agencies set up, including the Department of Human Services, if necessary, that can come in and can direct services where they're needed. I hope that answers your question.
Does the government proactively make those resources available? And somebody has died here, so it's a tragedy. And does the city or the county reach out to make the family members aware that there are services?
Historically, there hasn't been a real mechanism. There isn't a doorway with a name over the top, such as, and I'm just going to say, use a word such as a crisis center. You know, we used to, some years ago, there used to be crisis hotlines for people to call in who were experiencing stress or duress for whatever circumstances, and would attempt to direct them to necessary services. But I don't know that I can answer your question.
We're speaking with Mr. Stephen Holmes, the county attorney for Story County, and we're discussing the death of a young man on Central Campus on Monday, November 4th. Stephen, what happens now?
The Ames Police Department will conduct their own further investigation of the matter, and from this point on, the family will, I suppose, decide how they wish to proceed. And the community, I think, should be thankful that no one else was seriously injured or killed in this matter. And, of course, I think everyone listening would agree that, as you stated right at the beginning, Ursula, that these matters affect us all, and we can't escape them. It's part of the times we live in. Just today on the radio, as I was coming in, there was a report of the 11th homicide in Des Moines in 2013. The incidences of violence and the propensity of people to use violence in our society today is alarming, and it's difficult to know how best to treat it. It is.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. We've been talking with Stephen Holmes, the county attorney, who has been helping us try to understand the events that took place here in Ames and on campus on Monday.
Stephen, can I ask you one more quick thing? You mentioned the training for police. Do you know, do the police in Ames get simulation training where they're actually put in high-stress situations to Since it's not a big, an often current event in Ames.
Sounds like that's an invitation to Chuck Sykosh, the Ames Police Chief, to come on your program.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Stephen Holmes, Story County Attorney. KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, with Mr. Tom Veal. And we've been speaking with Story County Attorney Stephen Holmes about events surrounding the death of Tyler Comstock by police shooting at the Iowa State campus on November 4th. As we grapple to find understanding, we have asked Douglas Gentile, Associate Professor of Psychology at Iowa State, to join us. Hello, Doug. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
Of course.
Doug, we've been looking at what really has been a situation of escalating stress, which ended in a tragic and violent situation. And if you would, please describe from a psychological perspective what was happening. County Attorney at Holmes described the police officer's situation as being, quote, alone in an impossible situation.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Mr. Holmes said that was interesting in response to one of your earlier questions is, you know, this isn't a movie. And in the movies, on television, stressful events such as police shootings or violent engagements, you know, people seem calm and reasonable and able to see lots of things all at once. And that just isn't actually accurate for most situations. One of the things that happens once you're under stress, such as would happen for either the victim of the shooting or the police chasing, is this is scary. You don't know what's going to happen, and so under these situations, we feel this as kind of, you know, your heart racing. Well, that's true. What's happening is your body starts releasing stress hormones like cortisol and testosterone and adrenaline. And some of these do some really interesting things. They're very useful from a evolutionary perspective, but they're not so useful when you're trying to make quick decisions. So cortisol, for example, does a lot of things to your body. It causes your veins to constrict so that then if the tiger rakes you with claws, you will bleed less. It shuts down your digestive system so that because there's no point in digesting your breakfast if you might be someone's lunch. And as your veins constrict, your brain gets less blood, actually. So you are unable to think very well. In these types of situations, then what do you do? Well, you end up usually doing the thing that comes closest, first to mind, and that's going to be the thing that you've practiced the most. And so one example of this is after the Battle of Gettysburg, which was one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, they went around and picked up the muskets on the field of battle. And a huge percentage of them hadn't been fired. They actually were loaded, primed, ready to fire, which is interesting because if, I don't know if you've fired a musket-loading weapon, but it takes, say about a minute to go through the whole process. The firing is the short part. That just takes a second. But the, putting in the powder and tamping it down and putting in the wadding and then putting in the ball, and then getting it lined up with someone to, shoot at. The thing is, once you are ready to fire your weapon, it's terrifying. And so the soldiers wouldn't know what to do, so they do what they had practiced over and over and over again, which is reload the weapon. And so some of these muskets were found with like 17 different charges already loaded in them, never fired once.
So apply that to this situation.
So in the situation here, you've got a kid who's being chased by the police. He's not going to be making good decisions just because his brain is under tremendous stress. He's, his heart is racing. He's got all this adrenaline flowing, and he's not able to make good decisions. So you can certainly see this in the video where, he runs straight through the red light at, Lincoln Way. He drives up the wrong direction on campus in a one-way street in crowded areas.
Backs his vehicle into a police car.
Backs his, that was strategic, probably. That one actually is maybe a more thoughtful. It's not a good decision, but at least that one was a strategic decision. The blasting through traffic, it's hard to know. I certainly don't know anything about what his life has been like, or what decisions he's made in the past, or what stresses he was under at the time. So it's hard to second guess this, but what one of the things we do know is that part of the brain that controls impulse control, that actually can sit there and reason out, if I do this, then this might happen, or if I do that, then that might happen, and try to figure out, should I do this or shouldn't I do that? That part of the brain actually isn't fully developed until about age 25. And this is why teenagers make such dumb decisions. And teenagers at least give you an honest answer when you ask them, why did you do that crazy thing? Their answer is, I don't know. And that's the right decision. That's the right answer, I mean, because they really can't think it through and try to figure that out. So they just do what seems like the first thing that comes to mind. And they can't really put it into this bigger perspective of, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? Because that part of the brain really isn't fully developed yet.
Well, maybe this is a good time to tell our listeners something of your background so they can appreciate your comments better. Dr. Gentile is the director of the Media Research Lab at Iowa State University and is an expert in media's effect on children, adolescents, and adults. He's well known for his research on the psychological effects of video games. He's editor of the book Media Violence on Children and co-author of Violent Video Games Effects on Children and Adolescents. Well, Doug, since you're an expert, we'd like to briefly discuss a side note. Mm-hmm. The videos of the police chase taken from the police cars can be seen on the City of Ames website. While our team watched them, we could not help but notice it felt kind of like watching a video game, especially Grand Theft Auto. That's the best example in the best-selling computer game of all time. We felt that it was worth taking a moment to reflect on this, especially since these videos will no doubt be viewed by many in the next few days. KHOI reporter Cynthia McClure has a son who plays Grand Theft Auto, and she asked him about it. Let's see what he says.
So when did you start first playing video games?
Probably when I was 6. I'm 29 now, so that's over 20 years.
How has video games affected your life?
They made me very pale and socially awkward. However, most of my best friends I met by playing video games, and I'm still friends with them. So take the good with the bad.
This is Cynthia McClure, and I'm with Albert Hames, who is an avid gamer, and he's going to share the view about Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto is basically just a sandbox game. You're allowed so many tools, and you can do whatever you want, but it was kind of revolutionary at the time because it allowed you to do whatever you want in a third person's perspective and run around a city. You make money, buy businesses, fly planes, you can actually go deep sea diving now.
How does it make you feel to play these games and to play Grand Theft Auto?
it's pretty fun because I get to do a lot of things I couldn't normally do in the real world. I get to fly a plane without any actual experience, but somehow keep it in the air. Like, I can drive a motorcycle up a flight of stairs really fast and see how far I can jump without having to worry about the medical bills or landing on my face and dying. This is kind of like making it so people can take out their frustration on other things.
So do you think that it's therapeutic? Do you find it therapeutic?
At times, but I'm usually not that angry anymore. I just play it for fun.
Do you make a difference between video games and driving a real car? How has the game affected you?
Actually, I think it's made me a better driver because the way they have the physics now, it feels like you're driving a real car, and how you move it and everything affects it, and it helps me with my spatial distance.
You said they've gotten better at this new Grand Theft Auto. Is this Grand Theft Auto number 5?
Yeah, it's kind of a big deal. It made like $1 billion in 3 days.
Do you want to share your thoughts on the game and how you think people are affected by it?
It's really fun, but you probably shouldn't let young people play it, even though they're going to get a hold of it, because most parents are lazy and don't really pay attention to what's going on in it. One of the people you get to play as might be a cannibal, and they show really dark stuff. It's a dark game, but if you're mature and you can handle it, if a parent's like there and knows their kid and trusts them, yeah, it's probably not going to be a big deal. But if it's like a parent that isn't there, and then it's a kid with anger issues, yeah, you're asking for some trouble.
So do you think the emotional state of the person watching these video games, it's going to affect them and the boundaries may be lost?
Yeah, I wouldn't lie. I'd be lying and saying that video games can't make you mad, but it's like, how long is your anger going to last? Because there's times where you'll get mad at a game and then let it go. And then there's other people that just, I don't know, don't let it go.
Any other thoughts you want to share?
Video games can be really fun. You just got to monitor what your kids are doing and pay attention. You actually have to talk with your children. You can't let someone else raise them for you.
That's really great. Thank you.
We're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, with my co-host, Tom Beal. And we're speaking with Mr. Doug Gentile, who's an associate professor at Iowa State University. Doug, many people are likely, like us, to watch the police videos on the city website, and probably, like us, feel a resemblance to a video game when they watch it. It's almost hard to feel when you watch the video that this is real life happening and that a real life is being taken here, is that that's what we're watching, and that it's actually a real tragedy. Can you comment?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction when I saw it. And I guess on the one hand, it's almost a no-brainer that it looks like a video game, because that's how realistic video games have gotten. They're very good at looking like what real life looks like nowadays. So I don't know that that's particularly surprising. What was interesting is that because we've seen images like this so much in the media, that it is hard then to realize that what you're watching isn't just entertaining. You know, you sit here watching this high-speed chase, you look at, you know, all the people that, you know, times he could have crashed into people or cars, and that's exciting and scary.
Let me clarify one thing real quickly for those who have not seen the video. The video is literally the video taken by the camera on the front of the police car. So as you watch the video, you're watching who they are pursuing from the front of the police car.
Right. And you know, recognizing that this, you know, we see these types of images as a way of entertaining ourselves, which is a really strange idea if you think about it. Why would we want to be entertained by, you know, scenes of violence? But we've trained ourselves as a culture that that's a good thing. And then when we look at something like this, it's hard to actually realize that this isn't just one more of those entertaining scenes. This is a real, you know, horrifying event for everyone involved, the victim, the victim's family, the police, for the entire community. You know, this is a much bigger deal than it looks like just from a little video.
You know, as we were viewing the video yesterday, one of our group said, "Boy, that's cool." And then they had to be reminded that this video we watched
ended
in a death.
Yeah.
Is it generally found that watching or participating in video games like this makes people more violent and more prone to feel that they are in videos?
Hmm. There are a lot of parts inside that question, so let's unpack them. First of all, there is a lot of evidence, hundreds of studies now that show that as you watch more media violence, people do become more willing to behave aggressively when provoked. Now, what's important here is we're talking about aggression, not violence. Violence is a very extreme thing. It happens very rarely. And violence is defined as a physical type of aggression that, if successful, would result in severe bodily damage or death. Now, that's not the aggression that most people encounter. You know, people encounter aggression daily. It's usually people saying mean things to them or being sarcastic or maybe pushing or shoving. And that's the level at which media violence tends to have its effects. It actually makes you more willing when you've been cut off on the highway to make a rude gesture. It makes you more willing when provoked to say something unkind, because that's kind of the real everyday level of aggression. And there are now hundreds of very good studies, and the American Medical Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Psychological Association, the two U.S. Surgeons General, et cetera, all on record saying, yes, the evidence is clear that media violence causes, they use the C word, that's a big deal in science, causes aggression in society. Now, second part of your question is, does watching a lot of this or playing a lot of this, how does it affect our ability to get around in the real world? In many respects, it certainly desensitizes us, as you noticed just watching this video, we don't recognize it for the real horror it is. We have to remind ourselves instead. We have this initial reaction that that's cool. So that's one of the levels. But then, underlying your question is, people often say, well, my kid can tell the difference between fantasy and reality, and so therefore they think it's okay. Well, knowing the difference between fantasy and reality actually is irrelevant. We all know that advertisements are fake, right? You know ads are fake. They still work on you. Knowing it's fake doesn't actually change its psychological effects at all. And so, yes, of course people know it's just a game when they're playing it. And of course they know it's just a TV show or a movie. That doesn't mean it doesn't affect them. And the proof of that is, if it didn't affect you, you'd call it boring. We want to be affected by the media, and then we like to pretend, oh, it doesn't affect us. Of course it does. Anything we practice over and over, we get better at. That's just how the brain works.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should say that the video is available on our website as well as
we'll put a link to it.
Yes, we'll mention that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting question. I mean, certainly a video like this is very useful for the county attorney making a judgment about, in the moment, were the police acting responsibly or not. But in a sense, I watched it and I found it almost a violation of privacy. I mean,
what do you mean?
If I were Mr. Comstock's parents, I would hate having that video up there.
But then, of course, he became a public.
It's his last moments, yeah.
Well, that's sad, but he also became a public figure during those moments. He lost his right to privacy by engaging in an act that made him a public figure for that time.
So it's a funny, this balance of information, and more information generally is a good thing, but it also struck me as a very private and personal thing that was happening here as well, and so I had a very complex reaction to watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we agree that the whole thing was a tragedy all the way around, no matter how justified the actions taken were, the families affected, the police officers affected, and for that matter, the whole community is affected, because it's a reminder that even here in central Iowa, where things are relatively placid and quiet, that violent things can happen.
And one of the interesting things, to compare it to media violence is this is one of those times where you see the truth. That, the media show violence as very, it's a very sanitized in many respects.
Sometimes even comical. It's almost
right.
It's a funny thing.
And that the bad guy gets what's coming to them, and the good guy is, is the hero, but in fact, you know, the perpetrator of a violent act is always damaged by it as well. And the perpetrator's families and the victim's families, and the ripples go out and out and out across time and across people. It's always a much more damaging thing to everyone involved than it's ever shown in the media.
Doug, let me ask you if you think the community itself, I mean, I suggested that the community has been affected by this. From your vantage point, do you think the community has been destabilized or upset or something in the long run, or is this going to be a short effect?
Well, yeah, I don't know that destabilized is a word I'd use for it, but certainly, you know, people were talking about it now, a couple days afterwards, and I think that, you know, any student on campus who actually saw this happen is going to remember it for a long time. Many of them are probably having nightmares to this day about it. You know, certainly, you know, anyone who knew Mr. Comstock is going to be affected for years. So I think that's, you know, that's the reality, but that's never shown when we make violence something that's entertaining. We just, you know, show the exciting part of the confrontation and never the aftermath, which can last for years.
Indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I hear the most kind of in during the day is confusion that people experience about when are the police going to shoot somebody and when aren't they? And I've heard all sorts of versions of what people think that is. And that's an inevitable response when there is a police shooting in a community where, especially in a community like ours, where this is a very rare occurrence. And so people, in general, those of us that live here have to think about it as a more nuanced situation.
Yeah, it's always a judgment call. Mm-hmm. I mean, every police situation, you know, thinking, you know, police have a tough job. They walk into a situation where they know very little other than, in this case, you know, a car was stolen. That's all they know. And then they have to try to decide how, you know, what are the appropriate steps? And they're making the judgment on the fly as events unfold. Once their car was rammed by him, then, you know, that changes the situation. That changes the threat. Now the police officer feels personally attacked because he has been. And so that's, you know, that, of course, changes all the stress hormones. That changes their response. And it also makes, you know, makes them realize they may need to make a fast decision later on, you know, to save people's lives.
In the simulation training where an officer is put into a situation where stress of that level is simulated, does that help? Like, does repeated experience with that make a difference?
I'm not an expert in this. I've read a few things, and it does seem to make a big difference that if all you do is you teach police how to safely use their firearm by shooting at targets and things like that, then once they're in the fast-paced situation where they need to make a judgment call, they are not prepared to be able to do that in a, you know, in a thoughtful way. And so, in fact, the best training is high-stress simulation. And this is one of the funny things about, you know, the conceal and carry gun debate and things like that, is that people think more guns out there make us safer. But that's entirely untrue, because in fact, once you're under stress, people don't shoot well. Mm-hmm. And so most of the situations where, you know, bystanders have actually pulled out their gun to try to help, they've killed other people, other bystanders. Mm-hmm. Because unless you train in a situation where you are, you know, under this high stress, you can't act well, you can't hold your arm steady, you can't aim well, you can't choose well. And so police and military forces go under much more rigorous training than the average person does, and they have to keep it up, because if they actually don't keep that level of training, it does go away.
We're speaking with Doug Gentile from Iowa State Psychology. Thank you, Doug, for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We've been listening to on Local Talk to information around the events of the police killing that happened on Central Campus. We spoke with Story County Attorney Stephen Holmes about his ruling on the police shooting. and on the death of Tyler Comstock on November 4th on the Iowa State campus. We thank Stephen for joining us this morning and for speaking on the issue.
And we also want to thank Professor Doug Gentile for coming in and helping us try to put this in perspective. And we also want to thank one of our own staff members for interviewing Cynthia McClure, for interviewing her son about the impact of watching video games. Well, with that, we want to thank you all for listening. Local Talk is rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. here at KHOI 89.1 FM. You can listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Find the Local Talk link under the Talk Programs tab on the homepage. You can find a link there to the Ames City Police videos of the car chase used as references for investigating the Tyler Comstock killing. Thank you to reporters Cynthia McClure and our whole crew, actually, for helping put this program together. Thank you to you as well for listening.
Richard Morrison is our studio engineer. Thank you, Rick. And our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. Tell your friends about our show and about KHOI. And please, as the year draws to a close, consider making a tax-deductible donation to KHOI. If we can find 500 members of the community, either families or individuals, who will donate $250 a year or more, we will be able to cover operating expenses for KHOI. KHOI is a not-for-profit, 501c3 community-based organization.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.